see some soaking mangas being, right?
Words are flowing out like endless rain.
I have a great news and even better news. Okay, great news. I'm not playing tomorrow night. And good news. I'm just
pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my heart.
The Devils can't get that passing to work. Galov had to watch that. He nearly gave it away, did it? It's a goal for Galov. Gave it away. And he kicked it right to him. It hit him. And it went in the net.
Nothing's gonna change my world.
This next goal could belong to New Jersey. They are 0 for 3 in the power play of the game. You think they're due? Here's his shot. Goal!
Nothing's gonna change my world.
I can tell you, I'm not a coach to analyze the effort of the team.
Like a million eyes, they call me on and on.
And that is all she wrote. In Philadelphia, the Devils will move on with a 3-1 win tonight over the Philadelphia Flyers.
Across the universe.
Why you have to mock me with the Beatles?
Why?
I play hard, I make money, and you have to mock me with the Beatles, why?
Why not play something else from Ticket to Ride, nice song, play that. Play nicer, a Walrus song, that nice song. What are you gonna play Universe for?
When I see Paul McCartney, I see Hot Blonde.
Like Siberian Husky. Like Husky. Simple Hot Blonde. That's what I see.
It's kind
imagine
of obvious.
Imagine all the people.
What would be the ultimate Ilya Brizgalov Philadelphia Flyers Beatles song? We thought it was, I was talking to Elena last night. We were going to use Space Oddity, which would have been good. The David Bowie tune. Elena raised me back. Nope. Across the Universe. Yep, there it is. Is there a better Beatles song, though? For Brizgalov? Help comes to
help,
mind.
Help hard
might
day's
be
night.
One. Yeah. Oh, Hard Day's Night. Yep, that's a good one, too.
Yeah, last night happened. Here's the thing as a Devils fan that I'm kind of wrapping my brain around. Like,
oh, has it gone down yet? Has the swelling gone down yet, by the way?
It has. I mean, there's no, there's instructions on the package if that doesn't happen.
That win last night must have been like Viagra for you.
No, but here's the thing. It's not, like, though. It's not. Like, I've seen this team win in moments of complete chaos and unpredictability, like the Jason Arnott goal to win the cup in 2000, other Cravens. Situations, overtime games, that kind of thing, right? This was an assassination. Like, this was a slow poisoning. This was a series that it became quite apparent once the Brizgalov-Clarkson snafu happened in the first period. And by the way, David Clarkson joining the America vs. Wyszynski podcast. And
holla!
It would be very exciting. Yeah, once that happened, you said to yourself, this is it. No Giroux. Their goaltender just made the gaffe of the series. I'm happy. But I'm more like stunned, and I'm more like, how did this all happen than I am, you know, painting 1975 on the side of the townhouse.
Oh, 37 years? What are you trying to say?
And counting.
Here's the thing. We'll talk about the Devils plenty. And, I mean, you're in a really unique spot right now in your own brain, and I want to get into that with you a little bit later on. Oh, did we mention David Clarkson's on the show today? but I want to talk about what must be. We opened up with Universe there by the Beatles and dropped in some Ilya Brizgalov quotes. And you remember last year when Ed Snyder said, and I'm paraphrasing here, Mr. Snyder, I apologize. We will never talk about net minding during the playoffs again. We are solving our problem. Well, we're talking about netminding, Greg Wyszynski. The $51 million man, Ilya Brizgalov. I don't know whether you call it the curse of Pelle Lindbergh. I don't know. But for whatever reason, that's where, you know, Philadelphia is where goaltenders go to end their career and destroy their reputation. I can't explain it. I can't explain black holes. I can't explain string theory. And I can't explain why there's just something about Philadelphia that eats its netminders. It's like goalie quicksand, right? The minute you sign on the dotted line with Paul Holmgren, the Philadelphia Flyers, your career goes down the mud. It's just, it's finished. It's over. I don't know how Ilya Brizgalov comes back from this one. And I don't know what the Philadelphia Flyers do with him. And even if there's a buyout amnesty, right, in the next CBA wish, do you really think that there's an appetite to spiff a, what, $45 million check? I don't think so. Not a chance. They are married to this guy for better, or in this case, for worse. How does Brizgalov go back?
Ed Snyder said before the season, by the way, this was after the Flyers were eliminated by the Bruins. We are never going to go through the goalie issues we've gone through in the last couple of years again. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, he's right. We didn't see Bobrovsky. We saw one goalie take the loss. We didn't trade off or anything like that. But I agree with you. You know, the thing about Briz is this. He's going to get an untenable amount of shit for what happened in Game 5, and rightfully so. It was a terrible play. It was a terrible play. It cost them the game.
That was the game-winning goal?
Seriously? In Game 4, he was fantastic. He kept them in the game. They had a sniff of victory in that game because of Ilya Brizgalov. So I won't. You cannot lay this at his feet in the same way that you could lay the Penguins losing at the feet of Marc-Andre Fleury, who was a complete sieve. Briz had his mistakes, but he wasn't a complete sieve. And that's why this is a unique point for a Flyers goaltender. This is not someone who's completely incompetent like they've had in past years. You know who this is, Merrick? This is Yevgeny Nabokov. This is a guy who played pretty well, had some struggles, won some games, but made enough enormous and more so than anything else timely mistakes that he cost his team the series.
So it's, well, then maybe it's not just Nabokov, but it's Luongo.
It's all Russian goalies, Merrick.
Oh, okay, sorry. Oh, right, okay, I apologize. It's Mishkin, Stretchak. You know, Tim McAuliffe.
Because they're lazy, really.
Of course, yeah, just ask Kolbuchar. Hey, Tim McAuliffe tweeted out something really interesting. You go back last year, the Philadelphia Flyers played 11 games. Three goaltenders, Boucher, Leighton, and goalie Bob. The accumulative goals against average, 3.45. The save percentage, 8.89. This year, the Philadelphia Flyers played 11 games again in the playoffs. The goals against average, almost identical. Instead of 3.45, 3.46. Save percentage, a hair lower at .887. It's identical.
Yeah.
From one year to the next. Nothing has changed other than Ed Snyder every week. His hand shakes as he has to write that check to the goaltender. I would love to have been a fly on the wall last night, by the way, because you know Ed Snyder probably went in the room.
There is something else that changed, though, which is that Dave Tippett no longer coaches Brizgalov.
Huge.
I mean, you know, let's be honest here. Again, like we mentioned yesterday, if you're a Flyers fan, you're watching Richardson Carter 4 wins away from playing for the Cup, and you're watching Mike Smith put up ungodly numbers in a system that made Brizgalov. The evidence is clear. Brizgalov gets the contract because of the system he was playing in, because of the talent he was playing behind. Now, here's the question, though, and the essential question, you know, those stats aside. Are we having this conversation of Chris Pronger as the linchpin of the defense in front of Brizgalov during these playoffs?
Nope. Not at all.
So it's still a matter of the blue line in front of him rather than the goalie between the pipes.
There was a number of issues with that Philadelphia Flyers blue line. One of them is that there was no Chris Pronger. A second issue, and New Jersey exploited this, and we'll ask David Clarkson about it. I know players are come shy about talking about specifics when it comes to strategy, but when you look at the Philadelphia Flyers, there was only one right-handed shot on the blue line, and that guy was scratched, Pavel Kubina. Now, I understand the Detroit Red Wings have only, what, two, maybe three right-handed shots in the entire lineup. But when you're an attacking team and you say to yourself, okay, everybody shoots left, we can now exploit that fact and load up on one side, The Philadelphia Flyers really do themselves a disservice by not having, you know, different hand shot options in their own zone. You can do that if you're the Detroit Red Wings. I don't know that you can do that if you're the Philadelphia Flyers. I think Kiemannen was probably dinged up. He always plays dinged up. Braden Coburn was probably playing about 5 minutes too much to compensate for some of the losses. Nicholas Grossman, God bless him.
Yeah.
You know.
And the guy who scored the insurance goal in game 5 has a herniated disc. Come on. Injuries are injuries are injuries. We know. But, you know, mentioned the Red Wings. And, I think it's interesting about the Red Wings because I think that there's going to be a parallel drawn between the Flyers and the Nashville Predators in the sense that the Flyers, you could argue, won their cup in round one by beating Pittsburgh in a series that was emotional and contentious and actually had a dynamic in which the Penguins rallied, so you had to expend even more energy to extinguish that flame. And you could argue that the Predators beat the team that they have been measuring themselves against for years, and
true,
that catharsis was a relief, and then they weren't able to muster up the same kind of stuff for the Coyotes. I don't necessarily believe the second one as much as I believe the first one. The Flyers blew their wad in round one. And, you know, again, you track it back to game two of this series, up 1-0 in the series, up 1-0 in the first 3 minutes of game two. No Kovalchuk for the Devils. They punched the clock. They thought it was done, and they didn't win another period from that point on. And it's inexplicable that that happened.
The emotional letdown was huge. And you know what you really saw with the Philadelphia Flyers, which was with the kids? Because when you look at the young players, where was Reed in this series? You know, James Van Riemsdyk was taking bad penalties. Where was Sean Couturier in this series? I mean, some of the key guys, Claude Giroux, of course, suspended for the closeout game last night. But some of the key young performers that helped to shut down the Pittsburgh Penguins, those key young guys that turned the Philadelphia Flyers squad into the comeback kids, not just in the playoffs, Wish, but all season long. They were invisible in this one. And you wonder how much, because you listen to veterans, and they all say the same thing. Don't let the highs be too high, and don't let the lows be too low. Just be even keel. Don't get carried away in the emotions. When you look at the young kids in the Philadelphia Flyers, after the Pittsburgh Penguins series, they were spent. Like, that was such an emotional explosion for some of these young kids. They just couldn't recover in the second round. And that, I think, will be the learning experience for all those kids. You agree or disagree?
You know, I agree. I completely agree. And our learning experience for Drew, who again is 24, and he did a very stupid thing, and he cost his team a chance to rally in the series by not being in that elimination game. And that was a byproduct of the Devils doing to the Flyers what the Flyers did to the Penguins, which was play extraordinarily effective and efficient hockey, get good goaltending while the other team had a sieve at times, and then frustrate them. And the Devils didn't do it in the same outward way that the Flyers did the Penguins. They didn't goad them. They didn't have a full regular season of taunting that led to what happened in that series. But there's no question that when Dinas Zubrus embellishes a play, takes a little dive, does whatever he does, it gets under their skin. There's no question that the Devils got under the Flyers' skin, and the Flyers themselves got frustrated, and that manifested itself in what Drew did. Now, you asked me at the beginning of the conversation about how I felt as a fan about this, and
yeah.
I think sometimes as fans we take on the personalities of the teams we follow. And right now, as a fan, like, I'm happy. Listen, I'm eliminated the Flyers. That's a very big deal. Flyers thought they had this one in the bag. Devils eliminated them. Did some trash talking last night on Twitter, but not a lot. Kept it in check, right? Kept it reasonable. Mm-hmm. But even then, you know, I was just told to eat a bag of dicks, which is, I think, Philadelphia affection. But I think you take on the personality of the team you follow, and I see what happened in this series, the Devils winning in 5 games and winning in such a dominating fashion that it's like I'm wearing the work boots right now. I see an efficient team, and I feel like it's okay, this chapter's done, just like the Florida's chapter's done. Maybe it's the sense of having been there and seeing 3 cups won and not really kind of having the same sort of wide-eyed enthusiasm for this sort of thing as a Devils fan whose team's only missed the playoffs twice since like 93. But I really kind of, it's like business as usual for me watching this series and seeing this team win and getting a sense that, okay, here we go again. It's not like popping champagne for whatever reason. And that might just be me as a Devils fan being a cynic, but that's kind of how I approach this win.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Be open-minded about this. How many people are you?
Like as far as tonnage? Probably one and a half.
No, when you watch the New Jersey Devils play the Philadelphia Flyers and extinguish the Philadelphia Flyers, how many people are you? Are you Greg Wyshynski, New Jersey Devils fan, or are you Greg Wyshynski, editor of the Puck Daddy blog at Yahoo Sports?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm always going to be Greg Wyshynski Devils fan, but I think that the other thing is more like a filter. It's more like a cap on the enthusiasm at times. Like, I watched the game wearing my Stevens jersey last night. Know that, Flyers fans. When I wrote that story, that even-handed story about the Flyers, I was wearing a Stevens jersey. So, you know, wow. Have that in your mind as I'm pounded away.
Did you make Sarah wear a jersey last night, by the way? I was going to tweet that to yesterday. I was like, put on the Don Lever jersey. the original Devil. Come on, man.
But I mean, it's like I got a job to do. I'm watching the game last night, not only to enjoy it as a Devils fan, but also because I have to write something after the game. And that's the balance in the press box too. Like, I've covered the Devils in the press box, and I try not to. I try to go to the and sit in the cheap seats instead. But you know, there's always going to be a passion there as a fan. I think the difference is, and sometimes Devil fans call me out on this, is one, I have to be even-handed. Two, I'm a born cynic, so I'm always going to approach the team maybe a little bit more critically than others because they're my team. You know, you're going to be harder on your own kid than another guy is going to be on your kid. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like you're harder on your own. And then the other thing is that, you know, I just can't, you know, I'm not writing on the message boards back in 95, you know, where me and Katie Baker, you know, made our bones. I can't be the guy who's just going to drop F-bombs and make terrible references about the Flyers. This is my gig. My gig prohibits that. So I just do it on Messenger with Devils fans instead.
So how much has your job, how much has your career changed your appreciation of the New Jersey Devils as a fan? If you weren't the editor of the Puck Daddy blog, if you weren't, what number are you, by the way? 97 on the Hockey News Top 100? Is it 97? Is that where you're at now?
92 or 93, like higher than that.
Really? Check out your act. Wow. Missed the shooter. How much is that? How much of that has changed the way you, either you behave or the way you enjoy hockey, New Jersey Devils hockey specifically?
No, it has not changed.
Has it cooled it? Has it cooled it?
Oh, God, no. No, not at all. I mean, it breaks my heart when people say that, when I read bloggers that are like, because I do this gig, I can't be as passionate about my team as I used to be. I mean, it's not that I'm not as passionate as I used to be. It's that the outlets for that passion have changed. I can't go to a Devils game now and sit in the stands and make jokes about Sidney Crosby, because there's going to be somebody with a phone next to me that somehow recognizes the voice or recognizes the face. And then all of a sudden it's on Twitter that I said this about Sid in his brain. You know what I mean? So like, that facet of it is done. And I'm willing to accept that. But the passion for the team has not waned. I mean, sometimes you have to defer the passion until you write your story. But it doesn't mean that my first phone call wasn't to my dad last night, giving high fives across the phone lines from Virginia to New Jersey about this victory. I mean,
How did your dad feel about it last night?
Oh, he was doing a jig. He does the jig whenever like he figures out how to split the cable in the house too. I mean, he's a very easily pleased man. But
all right.
But you know what I mean? Like it's just a different form of it. But the notion that you can't do this gig and be a fan at the same time is something that I will spend the rest of my career dispelling, because we are 4 years into the blog. I wave my freak flag as a Devils fan. Everybody knows where I stand. Sometimes it's to my detriment, where I can't be critical about a team they're playing without somebody saying it's a homer take. Sometimes it's a detriment because I have Devils fans telling me, oh, because you aren't waving the pom-poms for the team, you're intentionally trying to be negative about them, when it's in fact the same cynical take I've had for this team since I was a kid. I mean, there are going to be times when I'm going to take undue criticism because I am a fan, but I'm doing this because I'm a fan. I mean, I'm also a journalist. I went to school for it, but it just so happens that I lucked out and was able to channel my passion into my profession. But it doesn't mean I'm going to give up one for the other, because frankly, I'd give up the blog. Being a Devils fan and being a hockey fan to me is more important than doing the blog. I got to be honest.
Is that right, eh? So if aliens arrived this afternoon, right after, I don't know, right after the podcast was over, knocked on your door and said, Greg, right? Oh, yeah, Greg, you're alien, right? Yeah, alien dude. Wyshynski, right? Yeah, okay, this is the guy. Make your choice. You can either be the editor of Puck Daddy blog, or you can be the guy that wears Scott Stevens jerseys at home and watches Devils games.
I would choose the latter, because it's not about being a Devils fan, it's about being a hockey fan. And if someone said that I had to get my card pulled and be one of these drones that I see on the road or at games that simply can't enjoy the sport anymore because it's too occupational, what's the sense of that? I mean, what is the sense, and to me, that's the decision. Like if when I say the blog or the fandom, I mean the fandom or having to give up that passion to do this job.
And I've always and said I, this, I, man. I've we've seen, Greg, we've both worked here long enough. We know the guys that we're talking about, and girls for that matter as well, the ones that are just hanging on because it's the paycheck. But they've come to now be disgusted with it. They hate the fact that they're done with it. I've always said, and I hold to this, I completely hold to this, the minute I don't like hockey, and I don't think it'll ever happen, but if it ever does, like the minute I stop enjoying the game, I'm out. I'm going to go do something else. I'll go back and work at Park Lawn Cemetery where I worked during university. I'll go back to digging graves. I'll go back with that in a flash the minute I don't enjoy the game.
And the two things about this are, you know, one, you're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, listen, the blog and the podcast have a certain modicum of success. And I think part of that success is connection with the audience. You know, the fact that I don't approach this like I'm somebody who doesn't understand fan passion or hasn't cried when his team lost. I mean, for God's sakes, it makes me a gigantic pussy, but it also makes me real. The other thing is, like, and everybody knows what I'm talking about. I'll call him out, Damian Cox. Damian Cox, you have a good relationship with. I'm not necessarily have the same relationship with the cat. But when I read that guy on Twitter, I know he's trolling, but I say to myself, why are you even talking about something that you clearly hate? I mean, there isn't a night in which you aren't complaining about the state of the game. One team's playing too defensively or physically. One team's playing too low. What is the point of even commenting on this sport if you can't actually enjoy it? It's like hating pizza, but eating pizza.
It's like hating pizza, but eating pizza. Having worked with Damian and knowing Damian a little bit, I don't want to turn this entire podcast into a discussion on Damian Cox, but I know that he does love the game. The elements.
When
thing
you say
about
the
game,
do you mean tennis? Because I'm pretty sure he loves tennis.
I think that might be his first love. But I know he does love hockey. But the thing about Damian is the things that upset Damian or the things that Damian doesn't like, he's louder about. Like he's louder about the negative elements about something than he is about the positive elements about something. And that's just who he is. Like I'm a guy that tries to surround myself with a lot of positivity. I like to surround myself with friends that are positive. I've tried to take all the negative in my life and get rid of it. You know, I don't like being around it. The older I get, the more that I realize that everything is pretty much attached and there's not a difference between the rug and the walls and the person and the TV. Everything is really the same thing and we're all moving towards a singularity. I'm getting into Terrence McKenna territory right now, so I'm going to stop. But what I look for is patterns and holes of positivity. And that's what I surround myself with. But that's just me. Like, and when I was younger, I would always look for the differences in things. This sucks, that's good, this is different, that is different. You know what I look for now, and I do this in hockey more so than anything else, and that's why I go off on tangents about the history of the game, Wish. I look for patterns, and I look for the way things are similar as opposed to the way things are different. You know, I get on my little high horse about, oh, respect in the game. Everyone's talking about there's no respect in the game. The reason I always want to go back and find areas where, you know, that shoots that in the face is because I look for a pattern in all of it. Like, I look for the way that things are similar to the way they used to be. I don't look for notices of difference. I look for notices of similarity. That's the way that that's the way that I enjoy sport, through a focus of positivity and through a discussion of similarity as opposed to a discussion of difference. But that's who Damian is, and that's who I am, and that's who Greg Wyshynski is. And everyone's different.
But inside, we're all the same.
We are.
Except for Flyers fans, because they have no soul. There's a dark pit there. Wow. With that, let's, 1975? With that, let's, start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
That's our hockey, you know, it's only a game. Why do you have to be mad?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Sedin is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Versus Wyshynski.
Coming up in a few, David Clarkson of the New Jersey Devils to join us.
Awesome.
About Merrick's raging hard-on that he has.
My right favorite. Hey, listen, you have a favorite team, right? You know me. I'm not a team guy. I'm a player guy. It's my favorite player in the NHL.
The table is lifting as we speak, levitating above him with his turgid.
Oh, what's that? What's that?
Stop question of the day. Question of the day here on Merrick vs. Wyshynski. Tell us what's going to happen in Game 6. Who wins Game 6? What's going to go down? Caps, Rangers tonight. Rangers with a chance to close this thing out Caps trying to extend it. Capitals, again, have not lost consecutive games in these playoffs. And Braden Holtby, that would, of course, mean he's undefeated. But his save percentage in these games, Merrick, is like upwards of 960 or somewhere around there after losses. So he comes to play.
The stat, I believe, on Holtby is 28 consecutive starts with no back-to-back losses.
That's crazy. That's just
crazy. That's insanity. But at the same time, I don't know, and watching the way Brad Richards is playing right now, I don't know that Brad Richards, this is going to sound weird, Doug McLean was making this point last night on Hockey Central, I don't know that Brad Richards is going to let his team lose. Does that make sense? Like, there are just some guys that say, get on my back, we are going to win this game, hop aboard. Don't you get that feeling with Brad Richards?
Totally.
He's not going to let his team lose?
And that's why everybody who somehow bemoaned the contract and bemoaned the signing for the Rangers is out their gourd. I mean, they're just stupid. This is what they missed. This is the gamer that they've needed for the last several postseasons and not had. Not necessarily the guy who can score in the power play, although he did at the end of Game 5, but the guy who is going to make a play when they need a play made. You know Lundqvist is going to be good for Stonewall and somebody for two goals or whatever. They need someone to make a play. And Richards now, twice in this series, at the end of Game 5, and then on the assist to Gavrik in the triple OT game, made a play. And that is the difference between the Rangers going out and won, and the Rangers now potentially advancing to the conference final to play their eventual eliminator, the New Jersey Devils.
You need a big goal scored to tie things up. Call Brad Richards. You want an overtime goal to salt things away. Call Brad Richards. You want a Conn Smythe Trophy candidate. You call Brad Richards. Or if in the dying moments of a one puck game you need someone to jam his stick into an unsuspecting forward's face who's covering up the puck at the side of the net, hello Troy Brower. You call Brad Richards. Like, as far as being a skilled guy who's not exactly the beefiest dude. He goes to danger areas, doesn't he? Like, he goes to areas where you score goals and you get bruises, right? Like that, the goal against the Caps in the last game that sent it into overtime. It's not very often that you see an elite level skill player who is slight by frame go into that area. He's the guy taking shots. He's the guy looking for the empty areas. He's the guy looking for the open ice. He's not the guy that's putting his chin to his chest and barreling towards the net. Brad Richards in the playoffs is dynamite. Brad Richards in the playoffs is money, and he can score from just about anywhere. And that's why we had this conversation a couple of days ago, or maybe even yesterday on the podcast. He's jumped over Henrik Lundqvist as far as being the Conn Smythe Trophy candidate.
Completely.
For the New York Rangers.
Well, let's do that.
He's the guy.
Top four right now. I'll give you my top four.
Quick. Yeah.
Smith. Richards. Yeah. Kovalchuk.
Where do you throw Holtby?
Holtby is probably...
I throw Holtby ahead of Kovalchuk.
I would throw Holtby right between Kovalchuk and Lundqvist, maybe.
Let's not forget, though, it wasn't as if Kovalchuk heated up from the get-go.
No.
There have been a lot of dead games for Ilya Kovalchuk.
No,
he's heated up late.
A prickish Devils fan was so nice to bring up the fact that I taunted Kovalchuk for not having won a playoff round in round one. So yeah, he didn't start off all that well, but he's been great.
So I'll put Holtby ahead of Kovalchuk. Other than that, I'm right on the same money with you. I'll put Quick, I'll put Smith, I'll put Brad Richards, I'll put Braden Holtby, and then Ilya Kovalchuk.
Now, why Quick over Smith? Out of curiosity.
Why Quick over Smith? Because it's a team that's knocked off number one in the Vancouver Canucks and number two, the St. Louis Blues. That's why. I think the quality of competition has been higher.
I also think the quality of chances against Jonathan Quick have been better. Like, I think the Coyotes did a remarkable job in that series against the Predators to keep that offense on lockdown and not give them high percentage chances around Smith. I mean, Smith made plays, no question, but there's also no question that the Predators didn't really bring it. They didn't bring the heat in that series.
They were spent. To the point about the Flyers and the New Jersey Devils, after the emotional win against the Pittsburgh Penguins, there's an emotional letdown. This is the beginning of the podcast all over again, but I think Nashville was done. I think after game two, going back to Nashville, didn't you get the sense that this is a team that said to itself, oh man, we're in a lot of trouble. And even though you're never in trouble really until you lose at home, and the Nashville Predators had a shot at getting it back, didn't you get the feeling that the Nashville Predators said, hang on, we're supposed to come back with at least a split. We're the class of the Western Conference. The Phoenix Coyotes are just getting lucky. Right? Like, didn't you get that sense?
But the idea of the Nashville Predators having hubris, you know, is just so, isn't it just mind-blowing? Like, you're the Nashville Predators. You're supposed to be the underdog no matter what the series is. The idea of them being like, don't the Phoenix Coyotes know that we are the Nashville Predators? It's beyond the pale.
Who's the underdog in that series, by the way?
You see, that's a great question. By seeding, it has to be the Los Angeles Kings. By public perception, it's the Phoenix Coyotes.
Isn't that bizarre? Isn't that, I find that endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, but how much of that is us willing that into existence? Like, for me, I, as a fan and as a writer, it's easier for me to approach that series with the Coyotes as the underdog, as the team with the odds stacked against it, with, you know, and it, all that stuff. Like, it's easier to accept them in that position if they are the underdog. And L.A. being the large market team, you want to make them the favorite. They're the big bad in this scenario. And if the Coyotes thwart them, well, look at that. Cinderella found the ball. But it's not even the case. I mean, the Coyotes are arguably a better team than L.A.
Yeah, and I think we've been overwhelmed by the Phoenix Coyotes are leaving story that we forget that there's a really good team in there. Hey, knock, knock, Wish, guess who's there? Our guest. He is David Clarkson. He scored two memorable goals against the Philadelphia Flyers, one where he planked on the net, the other, with an assist to Ilya Brizgalov. David Clarkson of the New Jersey Devils joins us with the series clinching goal in his hip pocket. David, how are you today, sir?
Good, yourself?
We're doing very well. I gotta ask you right off the bat, the forecheck on the Ilya Brizgalov gaffe yesterday. What are you thinking when you're heading towards Brizgalov? Are you thinking at the side of your the back of your mind that here's a goaltender who struggled with the puck? Maybe he'll just, I don't know, throw it at my shin pads.
It was you know what, I was just getting on the forecheck and kind of just trying to force him to move the puck to one side or the other, and I wasn't thinking of getting a goal or anything like that. It's just one of those plays where kind of trying to put pressure on him, and I had no idea it was in the net until I heard the crowd and looked down, and it was behind him. But a pretty good feeling, but I'd be lying if I told you I planned that one out.
What did you say to him afterwards?
You know, I think all series I was trying to get under his skin a little bit or get into his head, you know, trying to be around the net. I didn't really say too much. I more couldn't believe that hit me and went in the way it did. And just one of those feelings that we had the lead and just a pretty good feeling for that to happen.
When you're beaking Brizgalov during a series, do you harken back to 24/7 or is it just stuff that's on the ice?
No. For me, it was just stuff that was on the ice. And I wasn't really going out of my way to to beat him or all series, you know, you didn't see me really too much around him. It was one of those things where it just kind of spur of the moment happened. And even when I was hanging on the net, it was, I kind of got shoved from behind there. And my brother texted me something about planking. I'm like, what's planking? I had no idea what this was. So, it was just both of those situations were just kind of spur of the moment. It just kind of happened quickly. So
the theory I have for you guys in this series is that the Flyers get up 1-0 in the series. They get up 1-0 in game two within like the first 3 minutes of game two. You guys are missing Kovalchuk in that game. And then for whatever reason, I feel like they punched the clock and you guys didn't lose a period after that point. What exactly happened, do you think, with the Flyers in this series versus what you guys were doing?
I don't know. I don't know what happened with them. I know our locker room, you know, whether we were down a goal going into the third, there was a couple games, or I think we knew what we had to do. We had to keep to our forecheck. We tried to forecheck them hard and stay on them and good in our zone, stay out of the penalty box. I think our penalty kill was outstanding. I think a lot of things add up for you to be successful as a team, and I think all those things kind of went into place where we – Our leaders in the locker room, Zach Parise, you know, you have Marty who's won cups, Elias, Kovey. We have a lot of guys that, you know, have a lot of experience and are caring people. And I think that's in the locker rooms when we were down a goal, the guys would say to each other, let's keep working. Don't worry about the score. And we end up pulling out games that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have or we didn't know we would.
Sorry, go ahead.
As you say, the fact that every Philadelphia Flyer, save Pavel Kubina, who was a scratch and didn't factor in, the fact that they all were left-handed shots, how much did that figure in, David, strategically on your forecheck?
You know, I don't think it was something that we really, you know, you obviously in your mind, you know, as a player that they had all left-handed shots, but at the same time, we weren't really too worried about that. Our job as forwards were just to get on the forecheck and finish our checks, keep the puck down low, and play that hard-nosed style of hockey that Pete DeBoer and the coaching staff asked of us. And that was really all we did. I thought our D played outstanding. You know, you have a young kid like Larson not playing the end of the season. He comes into the lineup and scores a huge goal and logs the minutes he did. And I think as a team, we did a lot of good things, and we've got to build off of going into the next round.
I think a lot of people are going to start taking notice that this isn't the typical, stereotypical, I should say, New Jersey Devils team now that you guys are in the conference final. Do you get the sense that maybe you were able to knock the Flyers back on their heels a little bit with the style of play that you guys have now? I mean, the reputation, of course, being a more defensive stance, but the forecheck was ferocious. The offense came in waves. You guys were leading them double digits in shots in the second period at times. You had guys like Scott Hartnell saying, "We didn't realize they were going to come out this hard." Do you think you caught them by surprise?
You know, maybe a little bit. I think the Philadelphia Flyers team deserves a lot of credit. They're a good team. You know, they had us on our heels at times, but I think as a team, we went in with a game plan and we knew what we wanted to do. No matter whether we won or lost the game, we had a game plan, and that was to pressure them the way we did and to stay on them and do those little things. And I think you couldn't have asked for it to go a better way. But yeah, definitely, I believe this is where the Devils organization belongs, and it has belonged there for years. And unfortunately, it hasn't been there, but now we're playing well and doing those little things. So it's definitely exciting. This is the farthest I've been to playoffs, and I'm pretty excited myself.
Meanwhile, in junior, you won a Memorial Cup with Peter DeBoer and the Kitchener Rangers in 2003. He's your head coach now with the New Jersey Devils. As a player, David, you've changed. Is Peter DeBoer a different coach now than when you had him in junior, or is he that same guy?
You know, I think he has a lot of the same. He thinks the same way. I think obviously a change a bit over years or working with kids to adults, but he still has that hard work ethic, the structure, the system, and he believes that if you stick to his system and do those things that he asks, then you're going to be successful, and that's what we've done. We've just stuck to what he's asked of us and working hard, and it doesn't hurt the forwards that we have up front and the lineup, but he's been incredible. You ask around this locker room, and the guys love him in the room, and you know, even to my career, I credit a lot of what I've done in my career to him, and just making the NHL, I think he's helped me get here. So, the fact to have a good season and to be this, you know, where we are right now and having him as a coach is feels pretty good.
Last one for me, in the last couple of postseasons, Marty has maybe given up a goal he'd want back, let's say. But I think since Game 6 of the Florida series, he's been very good. He has been a backbone for you guys. How much inspiration do you take from seeing the old man flop around like he does and still be able to get this stuff done in the semifinals?
Yeah, he's been outstanding. You know, he's had an unbelievable season for us this season. And you know, like you said there earlier, there were games against Florida where we had, you know, we could have been out of the game within the first 20 minutes of the game, and he somehow stood on his head and made saves that, you know, you'd seen him make 20 years, you know, when he first started, and it was amazing. He's a big leader in this locker room, and he's a guy that, one of the hardest working guys in practice every day. So, it's great to see, you know, him doing well and leading this team in the direction he is.
And another leader, David, last one on this microphone, Ilya Kovalchuk, who after the game yesterday said something like along the lines of, "It's so nice to not have to go to the World Championships right now. I love this. He's having a great time." We know what he's like on the ice. Tell us what he's like as a teammate off the ice.
He is one of the, you know, he just has a huge heart. He has a huge heart for every guy around him. He's one of the best teammates I've had. You know, he's a caring person and a big leader in that locker room, especially in this playoffs. You know, he battled through a bit of an injury there, and we lost him for a game. He comes back and scores a huge goal the next game again last night. And, you know, he's impressive to watch when for you guys and the people sitting up top watching them, it's like, wow, how did he do that? But it's the same for us on the bench. You know, you sit there and see him make a big play, or and in these playoffs too, he'll block a big shot, and you know that if you're the next guy, oh, you don't block that shot, it looks pretty bad when he's out there blocking blocking shots from the point. So I think, you know, right now we've got everybody on the same page and doing the right things right now.
Well, David Clarkson, we wish you well in the Eastern Conference Championship. Congratulations on extending the misery of Philadelphians to a 37th year without a Stanley Cup. And good luck to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
There he is. And, you know, the point about Ilya Kovalchuk's a good one, too. And I wonder, because we saw him, like, he's back-checking, Greg. Like, he's watching his minutes on his shift. To David's point, he's blocking shots. And it's Pete DeBoer behind the bench now, but I wonder how much of that is Jacques Lemaire.
I think it's Jacques Lemaire and the entirety of the coaching for this team, like Adam Oates and the way that they've managed the power play. And then, you know, I've been kind of hard. You want to talk about Jersey cynicism. I've been kind of hard on this blue line. I've not been impressed with the blue line for a lot of the year, but there's no question that they've played better in the playoffs than they did in the regular season. And that is Larry Robinson's work, my friend.
Yeah.
That is being positionally sound in your own zone, not running around, giving Marty puck support, just really playing well and not allowing the Flyers a sniff in some of these games. Now listen, here's the thing I got to tell you before you continue. How many guests do you think we've had on this show, roughly? Upwards of 200 maybe this year?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. I can count on one hand the number of guests that have received a tweet from a penthouse model.
I just
saw
that.
They're on the air.
I don't know who it is. I don't know who this person is because my knowledge of X-rated material is embarrassingly bad. But who's Devin Alexis?
According to Devin Alexis, and by the way, her bio is that she's an adult model, a former Miss Howard Stern penthouse model.
Yeah,
she has 75,000 followers, which again confirms that I need to take my top off more. I've only got like 54. She writes to David Clarkson via our two Twitter feeds, tell him he is hot.
Yeah,
David Clarkson, the first Merrick versus Wyshynski guest outside of George Richards of the Miami Herald, who are a penthouse model, has written in and said, tell him he is hot.
3 hours ago, she tweeted, nude in tub, smiley face. And then 9 minutes ago, tell him he is hot.
So just to recap the last 24 hours, Ilya Bryzgalov plays a puck off his stick for a game-winning goal to clinch a semifinal series in the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yeah.
And a penthouse model says, oh, by the way, radio hosts, tell him he is hot.
Tell him he's hot.
You know,
honestly. Should I click... What will happen if I click on devinalexis.com?
I don't know. What kind of virus protection do you have on your computer? Not saying she's dirty, just
wow.
Saying that you don't know what the internet holds.
I have a MacBook Pro, sir. I don't need
oh,
to worry
fine.
About
click
things
away.
Like viruses. Okay, let's see what happens.
I think my sister was also a David Clarkson fan.
Holy smokes!
David Clarkson's Jeez. Definitely got a bit of a following, a female following. You know, we should do that one day. We should turn the show over to our female listeners and also to Elena. Maybe let Elena host the show and just do ladies chat about the hotness of players.
That's cool. Why don't we do that? Why don't we just hand the podcast over a couple times?
Do like the top five, top ten?
Sure. I'm cool with that.
All right.
Sounds and what would we do? Just not be around?
We would come on as Jeffifer and Gregina. And we would co-host the show in really terrible high voices. Well, I think that Henrik Lundqvist's eyes are like pools of passion.
And then there was this little slut in San Jose, and every time he went to the coast, his cell phone somehow died.
That's right. I'm sorry. We are talking about, we have to be like 1,000 times more catty if we're going to fill this role.
Yeah, exactly.
She's not even good for him. He doesn't even go out anymore. Oh, look at that. You can still see the price tags on those things. Oh, those aren't real. He's a mino, married in name only.
Thank you.
Very good.
All right, so Devil, I asked him once,
is he married? He said, well, my wife is.
Oh, okay, yeah, very good.
Oh, we're going to pick up Devil's Flyers in a few with Frank Saravelli, who's also going to talk about this lawsuit that some Flyers fans have filed against the team. I wrote about that on Puck Daddy Now. You can check it out if you're listening to the show, but it's going to be kind of interesting getting into that. But back to Caps Rangers, rather.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
So again, the Dale Hunter thing comes up. And now there's been some scholarship done where a writer on Grantland, I want to say it's Bill Barnwell, wrote on Grantland that the Capitals have had 6 leads in the third period during these playoffs, and they've lost 4 of them. But they've won 3 of the games subsequently. So the question is, at the end of the day, are we completely overrating Dale Hunter and his ability to do what he did on this team?
Wait.
Versus maybe just sort of overrating him.
Which is a variation on the question now we've been asking for how long, Dale Hunter, genius or goofball? We've essentially been asking the same question every single day. And it all depends. Listen, if the Washington Capitals go out tonight, like the Rangers take him in 6, what will we be saying about Dale Hunter and how he specifically handled Alexander Ovechkin?
Yeah.
That's going to be the referendum, isn't it?
It's going to be a hell of a question to answer, man. Like, again, and the scholarship on this thing to me is fascinating because it's the collision between so many things. It's the collision between advanced stats and what you observe on the ice. It's the collision between the reputation of a player versus what his role on the team should be. It's almost like you want to root for the guy because what he's doing flies in the face of so many tenets of hockey logic. But at the same time, the logic overrules that sentiment. And you think to yourself, there's no way that if you are allowing the New York Rangers to have more puck possession than you, and you become the shot-blocking team, I mean, honestly, right?
Mm-hmm. This is going to be an exciting shot-blocking game again tonight, isn't it?
Yes.
If you're a fan of Craig Ludwig or Guy Carboneau... You're going to love this game.
All right.
Let me ask you really quick.
Ellen writes in.
Okay.
Hey, F you, that was shitty. What the F you, guys? Do you really want women to stop listening? Because making fun of your women listeners is a hell of a way to do it. We're not making fun of the women listeners. You guys are not the people we're making fun of. We know that you're not like that.
Okay, my life is getting really weird because Devin Alexis now is tweeting and adding my name onto it.
No, but for real, it's like if you're a female hockey fan and you're listening to the show, we know you're not like that. I mean, let's just say that explicitly. We don't think that the feckless puck bunnies who make the I want to take John Carlson to the prom signs are amongst the listenership. Of course, now I've probably offended them as well.
You just better stop. it was just a little joke that got carried away.
Elena, are you near a microphone, my dear? You need to hop on and play judge and jury for a second.
She can't talk for all women.
What's up, guys?
Did you find that last segment when we were doing our female voices to be sexist?
Did you see what I wrote to you guys?
Oh, you said it was sexist.
Yeah. Oh, there.
Well, no, just the idea that it's all well and good saying let's have a girls only show. I think that would be hilarious. Me hosting, talking to people like Ellen or Sarah Baker or all the great women that cover hockey that are out there. But then when you throw out, oh, and they can talk about all the players who are hot. I know that's not what you mean, and I know that's not what you guys are getting at, but that is, unfortunately, still, that's what a lot of guys, that's all they would think when you say we're going to have a girl host the show and we're going to have women on talking about hockey. The first reaction is, what, they're going to talk about who they think is hot?
Well, we would imagine there would be some hockey talk beyond that.
Yes, and like you said, you guys know that, and you know that's not who you're talking to, but there are still way too many guys out there who, when they hear that women are going to be talking about hockey, they either just tune out or they assume that's the conversation.
Well, listen, it's not sexist to say that could be the bit, that we have some female listeners and you host the show and you talk about hot players and do maybe a ranking. That's a bit. It'd be sexist to say you're going to swap stories about banging guys on the road. That's sexist.
Yeah, but it just, I don't know. No, to me, and...
It was a joke, by the way.
No, but the first reaction I have, like, exactly what I wrote to you guys, that's funny, but it is pretty sexist.
All right, fine. We apologize. Or I apologize. Merrick is conspicuously absent right now from this entire back and forth.
There is no win here.
He doesn't want to get involved.
There's no win.
He doesn't want to get involved.
You know what, Wish? I was told at a very young age, choose the hill you die on. This hill ain't big enough for me to die on.
Merrick also knows that he has to work in the same room as me for like the next 2 weeks when he's going to be coming in and working with me for the podcast instead of sitting in the safety of his office.
So I'm clear. Merrick and I doing affected female voices and talking about how women want to discuss the hotness of players is...
hysterical.
Oh, okay. But also sexist.
No, that's funny to me.
Oh, okay. God damn it, Elena. Why do you have to confuse all of us? I thought we were getting down the road of penance here. Now all of a sudden it seems like we're getting validation from you.
No, you get validation for the... Well, you made the crack last week about how if Jeff came and joined my hockey team when you thought it was an all-girls team that he would need to show up in drag. That amuses me the same way.
Doing the Buffalo Bill, too, and just tuck it in.
That's because I thought there were league restrictions on gender. I thought he'd have to show up, be like bosom buddies.
Well, if he was showing up to be the only other girl, then yes, he would have to. And I know Merrick would take one for my team like that.
Truth.
I bet he would.
I bet I look good in a skirt, too.
This is true. This is from Christian T. This is why women don't find the Three Stooges funny. They have no way to laugh at themselves. Again, why would you say? I'm sure. You see, now we're getting into gender here, and now it's
now you're going to open doors that you and go down roads that you don't want to.
Yeah.
No. Do you want to talk to Frank Saravelli about the
please.
Flyers?
Yes,
should we
please.
Do that instead?
Yes. Kate writes in, I totally want to host the Hot Hockey Player podcast. I'm not offended because I probably know more than critical men. See, that's the thing. And really, ladies, what you should do is take us up on the offer and then Trojan horse it. Just expunge the idea of doing a hot guys list and turn it into better hockey talk than Merrick and I can do. Like, that's the play.
Yeah. It's called, I believe Jacques Derrida referred to it as bricolage, using the master's tools to destroy the master's house.
Exactly.
Yes, I went all French post-structuralist on your ass.
That's exactly what Merrick, it's like Merrick said, it's decoupage. You do the exact thing what he said.
Decoupage.
Jen Delafuente writes, and absolutely agree with Elena with what she's saying on Merrick versus Wyszynski about sexism and female fan perception. Preach on, sister. So there you go. If nothing else, we have provided balance in this episode between the outright sexism of Merrick and myself and the measured, politically correct, thoughtful commentary by our producer, Elena Pagliarello.
To be honest, I was just stunned that somehow I have a Miss Penthouse and someone who runs a XXX website all about her body.
Listen, but again,
tweeting here to the program.
I have to say this, man. You're being a little sexist. You're judging a woman based on her occupation, which happens to be in the sex industry.
Dude, the two tweets are, tell him he's hot, and answering absolutely to, would you bang him? I don't think I'm stepping out of line. Just me. Just me.
Katerin writes in, you're not like those other women. You're okay. Not like those terrible sluts that only follow hockey for the dudes. You see, now I feel like I've offended the entirety of the gender.
Wish, there's no win here. Will
now I've
stop?
Lost. Now
there's
lost,
no win. There is
lost,
zero lost, win here.
I've lost the puck slut community now. I've lost the female listener, and I've lost the puck slut community in one fell swoop.
You're done. You were on Everest, right? You were on top of Everest when your New Jersey Devils beat the Philadelphia Flyers, and look what you've done. What, a scant 18 hours later? Look what you've done.
Tumbling on down here. Joining us now on the line to talk about the hottest ice girls in the NHL.
Oh,
our top 10 list. It's Frank Saravelli of the Philadelphia Daily News. Welcome, Frank. How are you?
So Frank, is it the Dallas girls or the Edmonton girls that are the hottest? Lay it on
oil drops. Oh, yeah.
Actually, you know, the Carolina Hurricanes and the New Jersey Devils, surprisingly, are not that bad. And it's funny, you know, I get tweets like that all the time, too.
Oh, like from women that run XXX sites?
This
is bizarre.
All
I have no idea. Oh, okay. Well, see, you're a player, though, dude. I'm like a dude in my early 40s with two kids.
Honestly, I know Frank. He's not a player. He just crushes a lot. Frank.
Yo.
What happened to the Flyers?
Jeez, I mean, it kind of beats me. I just don't understand how you can have such a big drop-off from knocking off the top team in the East to going down to what many consider to be an inferior opponent. And maybe that's my fault for underestimating the New Jersey Devils, but the Flyers just really looked like world beaters after that first round. And I think a lot of people were expecting a deep, deep run this spring in Philly, and the way they came out, it's like, you know, they never adjusted, and they never realized exactly what was at stake. It's like it didn't hit them until they were sitting in that locker room last night after the handshake, really for the first time.
But don't you think? I think you hit on the answer right off the hop there, Frank. When you talk about the emotional high the team was on coming off the Penguins series, and we saw this specifically with the Flyers kids who just seemed emotionally spent. Like I was making the point earlier on the podcast, you listen to a lot of veteran players and they'll tell you, make sure the highs aren't too high or the lows too low, or else, because if you ride that wave, I mean, you're gonna go crashing into a wall. And that's what happened to the Philadelphia Flyers. In a lot of ways, I think the battle of the Keystone State was bigger than the battle for the Stanley Cup in a lot of ways. And we saw this with Nashville when they got past Detroit. Boom, that was a dragon for them, and they run into the Phoenix Coyotes who steamrolled them. Do you think that maybe Pittsburgh meant symbolically and emotionally too much to the Philadelphia Flyers?
I certainly think emotionally. I mean, but it's, I guess it's, you know, I looked at that game six where the Flyers finished off the Penguins, and I actually wrote that, to me, that was game six of the Eastern Conference Finals for this team, because you look at the way everything shook out. I mean, I don't know how many more chances. I mean, it was exactly like this, you know, in 2010 when the Flyers, they beat the Devils in the first round, and they got a favorable matchup against Boston, even though they overcame that huge deficit. And then it shook out that they got the seventh seed or the eighth seed that year in the conference finals in Montreal, who they beat pretty handily. I mean, you look at the way it's set up, and Timo Thiemann was saying this last night, that, you know, there weren't any teams left that, to him, were kind of unbeatable. And that's the thing, is they got that first-round matchup that really no team wanted to get, and they beat them, and they played the Dragon, but it certainly probably was too much for them to handle. None of their guys showed up for the next round. And I'm really interested to hear tomorrow when we go back for cleanout day whether, you know, what guys were hurt and what guys weren't.
Bryzgalov's going to get a lot of Civ talk, but that's not fair because he actually played a hell of a game four. But it also wasn't exactly the difference maker in the playoffs that he was sold to be when Ed Snyder brought him in. Merrick mentioned it at the top of the show. Is this a curse? I mean, are we forever going to see Flyers goaltenders that just make a critical mistake, no matter who they are, no matter what year it is?
I think you certainly have to start to wonder. I mean, you look at that goal, and, I mean, Svechnikov, it was such a crazy, crazy bounce. It was so Romanchek-monic that it was outstanding. I mean, like, you couldn't even make it up. And I was sitting next to one of our columnists, and he said, you know, like, this is an only in Philadelphia moment. And he was so right about it. And looking back at it, I mean, that's going to be the goal that everyone remembers as, like, kind of that iconic Philadelphia screw up. But it's funny. He wasn't the guy at all. He wasn't the reason that the Flyers lost the series. I mean, did he steal a game for them? No. But at the same time, every time that he showed up, like in game four, this team completely disappeared in front of him.
I want to stick with the goaltending a second, and, you know, this was the hand-picked goaltender, not by Paul Holmgren, but Frank, as you know, this is Ed Snyder's choice. Have we heard from the owner of the Philadelphia Flyers yet? Has he spoken? I'm sure he spoke, in the coach's office last night to Peter Laviolette and crew. I'm sure he spoke to the team president as well. Perhaps he spoke to the players. Have we heard from Ed Snyder yet, sir?
We have not. I'm really kind of interested to see what he says, because you're right. He's the guy who went out and got Bryzgalov. He just said, kind of slammed his fist down on the table and said, get me the best guy available. I don't care what we need to pay him, even if he's totally the wrong guy. And it's just fascinating to me that, you know, Phoenix is now advanced further than they ever have without
him. Yep.
And it's just, and you look at L.A. and you start to wonder about last summer and exactly what went down. Is it really possible for the Flyers? Was it impossible to win with Mike Richards and Jeff Carter? I mean, I think for the long haul, they're probably in a better situation than they were last summer. But, I mean, a lot of time's running out for a lot of these guys. Danny Briere's not that young anymore. Timo Kiemenen looks like he's 87 years old. I mean, Jaromir Jagr's 40. He was nearly in tears last night saying he doesn't know how many more cracks he's going to get. It's really interesting to see what's going to happen this summer. They need to answer a lot of questions.
And the thing about it, dude, is that, you know, you think about Bryzgalov, you think about what Mike Richards used to bring to this team in the postseason, And it's almost like they didn't watch the playoffs. It's almost like Ed Snyder didn't watch Bridgegalov in the playoffs. Because this guy is, I mean, his reputation was not as a playoff performer in Phoenix. In fact, he was a complete sieve against the Red Wings. So if the remedy that you need is goaltending and it's goaltending in the playoffs, why wouldn't you find a guy that can play well in the playoffs?
Sure. It's such a fair question to ask. It's one of those things where I think you're right. They didn't do their homework. It's funny, one of the columnists was asking me last night, did they actually bring this guy in and meet him, or did they just sign him sight unseen? Because like you would think that if you would have a conversation with the guy, like how would you end up signing him? I mean, he has Roman Čechmánek, like I said, written all over him personality-wise. I call him the bipolar bowler. I mean, it's so hard to figure out why you would bring a guy like that in and just pay him all that money. And you have to wonder, well, what things would look like if this amnesty clause ever actually develops.
Oh, do you think for a second Ed Snyder has an appetite to spiff a $45 million check?
Absolutely.
Oh, do you know how much money $45 million is? What's that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not without even a question. I think he would do it if he was convinced that he's not the right
guy.
Wow.
Well,
wow. I mean, Merrick, keep in mind that the Flyers made some coin by raping their fans for Winter Classic tickets.
Keep in mind that the Flyers, they have still not reached the payroll levels that they were at pre-lockout. They were paying somewhere between $71 and $75 million a year in payroll when there was no cap. And there's we're still not close to that. So clearly they were making money then. So they must have been like, could you imagine like a year after the lockout when it's $39 million and they cut their payroll in half? They're making money hand over fist.
Ilitch was the same way in Detroit. I get that, and he spiffed the big check for Darian Hatcher. But $45 million. I mean, rich guys don't get rich by spiffing, $45 million checks to make problems go away and not see a return for it. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying that would be unprecedented in the NHL, and it would shock me.
The thing that's so hard to figure out is that he had such a good run there for like 3 or 4 weeks in like the meat of the season where he was, unbeatable. And then he goes down with that injury and he never really regains that shutout form that he had for so long. It makes you wonder, does this guy actually have something in him? Does it have to do with the personnel playing in front of him? And, it's interesting. They front-loaded that contract. 10 out of the $50 million was paid out this season, so I think he's down to 40. And who knows what the clause looks like. Maybe it's a two-thirds kind of thing. Maybe they say, it doesn't matter what it is, we're going to continue to pay this guy.
Yeah, who knows? I bought up the Winter Classic fan thing real quick. Frank, you and I both wrote about this in the last 48 hours. What's your take on this? For those who don't know, it's a class action lawsuit brought by Philadelphia Flyers fans against the team. There's already been a victory in small claims court by a Flyers fan. And the basic premise is the Flyers did not disclose to season ticket holders that they were going to not allow them to buy a Winter Classic ticket at close to face value for what their other tickets were. And that basically they resold the Winter Classic ticket along with tickets to the AHL game outdoors and the alumni game outdoors, added a ridiculous markup, and now there's a class action suit against it. What's your take on this whole matter?
Well, to me, it's really interesting because in the contractual agreement that was signed between season ticket holders and the Flyers, they paid for 44 games, and all of a sudden, after they found out that the agreements are usually settled anywhere from February to June or July. And so they're signed and sealed, and then the Flyers officially get word in September. They kind of had a feeling it was coming, but they get word in September that they're getting the game, so they need to figure out a way to, maximize their profits for it. Obviously, the attendance is tripled or almost quadrupled from a regular season game. And all of a sudden, they say, okay, well, that's not part of your 44-game package, even though it is a regular season game. And like you said, they charged an arm and a leg, and then they forced them to buy those two extra games if you wanted a Winter Classic ticket. So to me, where it gets interesting is the fact that there was a small claims case in one of the counties surrounding Philadelphia, a suburb, and the judgment, it was the identical case. There's now precedent set because there was a judgment and a fan was awarded $1,300 for the money that he paid to go to that game, and there was a month-long appeals window, and the Flyers chose to not appeal it. So this guy won, And now the same lawyer that represented that guy is now taking it to a class action suit to try and win for everyone. And you would think the Flyers immediately came out and said, look, this is frivolous. I can't believe it's just greedy fans trying to get the most out of the team, when really it was the team trying to get the most out of the fans. And now all of a sudden they're saying it's frivolous. But if it was so frivolous, don't you think they would use that corporate power that they have and unlimited resources and legal action to appeal and fight a decision that was already made? Now you have precedent set, and I think they're in a boatload of trouble.
How much is the dollar amounts involved, Frank? How much are we talking about?
Total?
Yeah.
It's got to be, you would think, in the millions of dollars.
Yeah, it depends on how many people get involved in the suit, Merrick. But, like, if you think about the markup on Winter Classic tickets, like, you had people that paid $95 for the regular season tickets and then had to pay upwards of, like, $350 for the combination of the three tickets, depending on where they chose their seat.
The cheapest package that fans could buy, I believe, started at $600 for one ticket. One ticket for those three games. So, it's where it really gets crazy is, you know, they're going to go through this whole discovery process now, and they're gonna have to pull the emails and all the financial data, and it's really gonna come out exactly how much money they made, and I think people are gonna be blown away.
Oh, on the Winter Classic?
they're gonna have to disclose their total amount of revenue.
Yeah. That's a lot of zeros, man.
that's maybe one of those reasons why Ed can afford to cut one of those checks.
There you go, baby. All right, Frank. Listen, man, you've done yeoman's work this year. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and we'll talk to you soon. Who's your pick tonight in Game 6, by the way?
I kind of like the Rangers.
Any reason in specific? I like the Rangers, too. I'm with you on this one, although my picks have been awful all season long. I just can't see Brad Richards letting this team lose again. What's your reason?
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed like the look on the cap spaces after the last game, I don't know, really kind of told me a lot that, you know, maybe they just don't have anything left in them.
Interesting.
All right.
All right, sir. Thank you for your time. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks, Frank.
Frank Saravelli from the Philadelphia Daily News. The big picture thing on this Flyers fan Winter Classic suing story, if you want to know what it is this. It's variable pricing. It's the notion that a team might be able to yank a ticket back from the season ticket holders at any point during their agreement and say, this game is now special. And by that, and the lawyers for the fans suing the Flyers and Comcast are making this argument that if you have, say, a game that's 3 weeks away that you think could be, the resolution of an Ironman streak,
right?
The resolution of a winning streak, maybe a game that you're seeing could be extraordinarily important as far as being a do-or-die playoff kind of game. Mm-hmm. What's going to prevent a team from yanking that ticket back, canceling the ticket from the season ticket holders and saying you have to repurchase it? Because essentially that's the argument they're making, is that when the Winter Classic became finalized late last year, and the tickets for these guys, for these season ticket holders that already been, you know, purchased, that they yanked the ticket back, put it in a package with the AHL game and the alumni game, ratcheted up the price something ridiculous, and said, congratulations, you now have the right to repurchase a ticket that we already sold you for a larger amount of money. That's the argument they're making, and it's kind of a freaky thing to think that teams might actually be allowed to do that. If this suit doesn't work out the way they're looking for.
And moreover, coming out of the lockout, I've had a real problem with the idea of premium seats, premium tickets, i.e. games that cost more than other games on the schedule, because what was the salary cap supposed to address? What's the one thing that, you know, outside of cost certainty, what was the one thing that the NHL needed, craved, assured us would be, you know, a panacea for all of hockey's problems? Parity. If the philosophy is that the salary cap is in place to encourage parity amongst the NHL, why is there not ticket price parity? Like, why should the, for example, the Buffalo Sabres have a premium ticket for the Toronto Maple Leafs? That's because the demand is there and Leafs fans will go to watch the Leafs play in Buffalo. So the tickets are disproportionately more expensive than they would be, say, on a Tuesday night against the Columbus Blue Jackets. But if every team at the beginning of the season theoretically should have an equal chance to win the Stanley Cup, parity rules the day in the National Hockey League is a hue and cry from all corners of the NHL. How do you make that sympathetic with a more expensive ticket? I've never understood that. And don't tell me supply and demand either.
And I don't understand the dynamic of a variable pricing for rivalry games that you know are going to fill the building, like when a, so say like a Pittsburgh or somebody comes to Columbus. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know if Columbus has variable pricing or not. But the idea that you overcharge for those games and don't drop down your prices when a team that you don't care about comes to town has always bothered me. It's a dicey thing. It's a dangerous thing. If you want, go back and look up what the Dallas Stars did in recent years as far as the flex pricing of games, where it was almost like depending on the demand for the game based on tickets sold, that adjusted the price of the ticket. So it was sort of always in flux, the amount of money you'd pay for a ticket, depending on how many people were already coming to the game. It's a really interesting topic. We will go into it, I think, during the off season, because I think there's an
summer
appetite
show
for it.
Yeah,
totally. But thanks to Frank, and thanks to everybody else that's chimed in on it. Game six tonight, Travis Wirtz. The Capitals will win because I am a believer in Hunter hockey, and Holtby is due for a shutout. Well, a game after a loss would be the time to do it. This is from Lanningham, I believe it is. Probably has been said 1,000 times, but there is no coming back psychologically from blowing Game 5 with 6 seconds left. The Caps will neither be focused or fired up, and the Rangers will step on their throats. They came back from triple OT.
They did. I don't know. Did it feel different? I mean, they were... Oh, man, did you see the look on George McPhee's face in the last game, Game 5, when it all went wrong? I mean... Dude, they're 6 seconds away from 3-2 lead, going back to close out, handshakes at the phone booth, Verizon Center, warm up your handshake in hand, because that's what we're doing here, son. George McPhee's? And it was like everyone just seemed bewildered on the Washington Capitals.
But the thing is, we've all seen scrambly, crazy, chaotic goals at the end of games to send games into overtime. I'd be more pissed off that they came out and allowed a goal in that power play. Kill the power play.
Oh, stick with you. 100%.
Stick up your man in the box that screwed
Bingo.
Up. The guy won you game 7 against Boston. You come out and you stink the joint. You allow that goal. You don't kill that penalty for Joel Ward. You allow that goal. That's considering more disappointing to me than a scrambly goal at the end of the regulation.
100% agree. Considering what Joel Ward did for you specifically in the Boston Bruins. Now, here's something interesting that we haven't really touched about. And you know what? No one's really touched on it at all. The high stick... to the head, the high stick across the head of Carl Hagelin at the hands of Joel Ward. And we all feel bad for Joel Ward. I feel bad for Joel Ward. You feel bad for Joel Ward. Anyone who's not a New York Ranger or a New York Ranger fan and has a pulse probably feels bad for Joel Ward. Watching him sit there in the box while not one, but two goals go in, the one that ties it and the one that wins. Everybody feels bad for Joel Ward. Now, I ask you this question. If that cross-check slash whatever you want to call it across the head of Carl Hagelin didn't happen in game 5 of the NHL playoffs, second round, but it happened in game 50 of the NHL regular season. Are we talking suspension?
No. You think so?
I'm just saying.
For being reckless with his stick?
Well, we've seen it before. Danny Briere and Franz Nielsen right off the draw. Boom! Butt end in the face. We've seen sticks across the head before. It gets suspensions. How come it wasn't even a conversation? Like, did anyone even entertain the conversation? Like, there wasn't a peep about it. He hit a man over the head with his stick. Was it deliberate? I don't think so. Was it, you know, inadvertent? Probably.
But you do have to be in control of your stick.
The thing is, we all think that because the Washington Capitals lost that game, that was quote unquote enough punishment for Joel Ward.
Yes.
But really,
you
the question you have to
about,
ask yourself
you
is.
Well, go ahead. What's the question?
No, I was just saying, the question you have to ask yourself is, what if the New York Rangers didn't score, okay? Let's say that Brad Richards doesn't score with 6 seconds left and the Washington Capitals win. Are we talking about a suspension?
I don't think we are, but essentially.
Oh,
what you're
you don't
saying,
think the Rangers think, are making a stink?
No,
you don't think the Rangers make
I
a stink about
I
a suspension?
I think it's an errant high stick. It's all it is. Besides, everyone knows Carl Hagelin can't earn a suspension. He is the guy who gets suspended. It's been proven.
Oh, just ask Alfie.
But listen, what you're arguing, and I think that this is a salient point, is that there is, because you're right, no one's made us think about it outside of Jeff Merrick on this podcast. I think you're making an argument for puck justice. And the code of puck justice said that this was an infraction. He paid the price, and his team paid the price because of that infraction as well. And we are all cool with it because we know the hockey gods, those Clash of the Titans MFers that are moving pieces around a chessboard up in a cloud somewhere, we know the hockey gods have sussed this out and have doled out a worse punishment than the Capitals could have ever received through suspension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they lost a game. Like, there was a deliberate effect.
Exactly.
From his actions. So to that point, I think that's why no one's making it. I just think that if it's game 50, people are talking about 3-game suspension. And if the New York Rangers don't win that game, I think there's a stink about suspensions. But not a single peep about it at all. Nothing.
The last reader email we will read is from Ellen. Ellen, sweet Ellen, who taught us all today about how terribly sexist Merrick and I can be sometimes.
Hang on, theory of ice, Ellen?
It's Ellen on email.
Oh,
same Ellen that torched us before.
Oh, okay.
Ellen writes in, I don't know who will win tonight, but I like for the Caps to take the next two just to see how tears will look in Henrik Lundqvist's blue eyes. Ellen, as a Devils fan, I must tell you that what you've written here is poetry. We would all like to see, as an admirer of the Henrik Lundqvist form and as a Devils fan, to see how those tears look in those blue eyes. I agree. Would be a wonderful moment in these playoffs.
But what do you think
with
happens?
I think the Caps win. The Caps win because it's been back and forth. It's been here, there with these wins and losses, and I think they'll probably win tonight and push it 7.
Here's how it breaks down as well. This is from John Shannon. If the Rangers win tonight, Western Conference Final begins Saturday, Game 1 in Glendale. Eastern Conference Final would go Sunday in New York City. Battle of the Hudson. If the Washington Capitals win, Game 7 Saturday at MSG, obviously, the Western Conference Final would start on Sunday. And again, if it does go 7, the Eastern Conference Final could start as early as Monday. So look for an announcement from the NHL sometime. Right now it is 3:17 Eastern. I would expect something by about 6 o'clock Eastern this evening.
All right, with that, we will end this marathon. Thank you to David Clarkson for joining us. David Clarkson working to rid the NHL's Eastern Conference of poison, eliminating the Flyers, trying to end the toxic run of the New York Rangers possibly as well. Really doing God's work.
You don't think Washington can win?
Potentially. Frank Saravelli of the Philadelphia Daily News, thank you for joining us and helping us with our ranking of ice girls, which I thought was a very great bit.
Sexist. What's wrong with being sexy? No, sexist.
Thank you to everybody for calling us on our bullshit.
You thank put you a greased, naked woman on all fours with a leather glove.
That's Spinal Tap, right. I was wondering where that was. I forgot that line. Thank you to all the Flyers fans that I know and that are in my feed for being good sports for the most part. The guy who told me to eat a bag of dicks last night, probably not in that message, but you know, overall, pretty much everybody was cool. Thank you to Elena behind the glass, once again keeping us in check.
1-2-1-2. That's our girl, the first woman of the Merrick Wyshynski podcast. Hey, hey, Greg Wyshynski. I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay.
I had a question for you. It did, too. But I can't remember what it was now.
All right, that's all we got, folks. Thanks for hanging in there for this marathon edition. If you're one of those people that work out during the podcast, well, you got a little bit more muscle built, didn't you? Isn't that great?
They gave you extra 22 minutes or figure? Something like that?
I'm out of water and I'm exhausted. Shut up and go. All right,
the
fine,
podcast.
We'll go.
Hey, let me make a point. Let me make a point to end the podcast. I want to give our friends that are maybe on the treadmill right now a little bit extra. Maybe you got, I can do a couple more sets here. Podcast still going. 2004, we decried the Stanley Cup final. We said, this is terrible hockey. This needs to change. The Tampa Bay Lightning and the Calgary Flames are bringing this thing to a standstill. We need new rules. We need a new game so this will never happen again. Now, Wish, if the Rangers and the Capitals meet in the Stanley Cup Final as here we are, the final year of this CBA under the new rules in the NHL, who would the head coaches be?
The head coaches for what again?
If it's the Rangers and the Kings.
It's Daryl Sutter and John Tortorella, the guys that started this whole thing.
The guys that brought it to a standstill in 2004.
That's right.
It would be an interesting, I say it for nothing other than it would be an interesting, oh, there's the music again. An interesting, I think it's Atlanta's way of saying shut up. It would be an interesting little bit of symmetry, would it not? To see it come right back to where it ended, I suppose, for the old dead puck NHL.
Yeah, I know, and aren't we all worried about the dead puck NHL? It's just like how now every team spends only $500,000 on their goaltender because Antti Niemi and Michael Layton went to the Stanley Cup final. I mean, obviously, what happens in one playoff series and one playoff run is indicative of the entire league. I mean, last year was terribly boring and not oh, that's right, it was the complete opposite of that, actually.
Oh, I remembered what I was going to ask you. Did we talk about the Rangers enough today?
That's funny. All right, we got to go. Thanks,
everybody. For everyone who tweeted us yesterday saying we didn't spend enough time talking about the Rangers because we had the nerve to talk about an elimination.
The nerve.
All right, we're going to go now. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye. Thank you.